Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Well, as it says on my own IMDb page, as a quote from me, differences about movies make the world go round. So exactly. Here we are. It's here we much are. more interesting when it's much more interesting when we disagree.
Exactly. Carl Needham, founder and CEO of IMDb, welcome back to our fourth annual conversation of our best of movies. How do you feel?
I feel great, but is this our fourth one?
This is our fourth one.
Oh my goodness, wow.
It is becoming one of my favorite annual traditions. And yes, as I was looking at our lists this year, I realized, you know, Carl and I, our top 10 lists, we always vary so much in the movies we pick. And that's what makes this conversation so fun. Because if we just picked the same 10 movies, it wouldn't be as exciting for listeners. So I'd love for you to guess, out of the 40 movies we've discussed, how many have we shared on our lists?
Four.
Four is correct. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's genuine as well. I mean, it's... was an absolute guess. Four.
That was a great guess. Yes, a strong four films, 10% over the 4 years, including the ones we're going to be talking about today. So for fans who are listening, you're going to have another fun conversation where we're going to talk about our 10 films to kick off IMDb's best of annual lists. And if you want to go to imdb.com/best of, you can see our running list of all types of fun lists that IMDb compiles from our amazing IMDb data, breakout stars, top shows, top movies, all that sort of stuff.
Well, as it says on my own IMDb page, as a quote from me, differences about movies make the world go round. So exactly. Here we are. It's here we much are. More much more interesting when it's much more interesting when we disagree.
Exactly. And so, you know, people that whenever I post these things, I always get comments like, "How does Carl watch so many movies in the year?" So this is also one of my favorite things to do. So me personally, this year I have watched 57 2021 new releases, which I always think is pretty good until, of course, we come to your number, which I'm sure stomps all over mine. So what are your Carl Needham watch stats for this year?
Okay. So overall, so far, as of the date of recording, I've seen 868 movies this mm-hmm. calendar year, and 296 of those are from 2021.
Amazing. I mean, that's almost tracking to one new movie per day. That's going to be just short, right?
I know. I was working this out, and unfortunately, like, I've still got time. I'm going to add some more movies to this list, especially like once the holiday season starts. Right. I can really work on my catch up for the year, but I will not get to 365 from 2021.
You know what? Let's just kick off right now. So, like I said at the top, Carl and I are going to quickly go through our 10 through 6 numbers. And if you want to check out Carl's full list and our other lists, you can go to imdb.com patreon.com/bestof. So I'll start with my 10 through 6, again, going 10 to descending order. So my number 10 was Fran Kranz's Mass, which I saw at Sundance earlier this year. My number 9 was Judas and the Black Messiah, directed by Shaka King. My number 8 is my only A24 film on my list this year, which I know, calls just as shocked as I am. And that is David Lowery's The Green Knight. Number 7, quickly became one of my favorite animated films of all time, is The Mitchells versus the Machines, which was directed by Michael Riannata and Jeff Rowe. And my number 6 was another film out of Sundance, and my only horror film on the list, which is also kind of a shock, which is James Ashcroft's Coming Home in the Dark, which is a really fantastic New Zealand horror film out of Sundance. So when I looked at that list, I realized, Carl, you know this, for me, I had a big life change this year. I had my first daughter. And so when I'm looking at my list, and we'll talk about it a little more as we go in more in depth, my movie perspective has slightly changed, I noticed. And some things that I think maybe would not have floated up to the top so much struck me a little differently this year. So yeah, so those are my 10 through 6s.
It's a good job you have Mitchells versus the Machines on there, which was also made my long list for my top 10. Because I don't know, in about 3 years' time, your entire top 10 is going to consist of animated family movies.
I'm very much looking forward to that. So Carl, what is your 10 through 6?
All right. Okay. So at number 10, I have Coda, which pretty much won everything at this year's virtual Sundance Film Festival. Number 9, I have The Little Things, which is directed by John Lee Hancock. And I want to give a shout out at this point because he also directed one of 2016's Hidden Gems, The Founder, which is the story of Ray Kroc, who is kind of responsible for the McDonald's restaurant chain. Little Things there at number 9. Number 8, Encounter, which stars Riz Ahmed, who's just phenomenally talented actor. And you'll remember, we must have talked about Sound of Metal at some point together, maybe last year on this.
Yeah.
And if not,
that was
well,
on my
we
list
should have
last
done.
Year, yeah.
Ah, yeah. That's where it's coming from. Michael Pierce, who made directed that, also directed Beast, which was one of my hidden gems of 2017. Plugging away here for the hidden gems, because I love to kind of find the things that maybe haven't been highlighted, maybe haven't quite hit the mainstream yet, and share them out via the Hidden Gems list. So definitely check out Hidden Gems. Number 7, Mothering Sunday. Now, you have A24. Mm-hmm. I have number 9 films. They are my equivalent of A24. They've made films such as Colette, Carol, Hyena, Byzantium, all of which made my top 10s in their respective years. Film stars Odessa Young, who was in Shirley, which was in my top 10 of 2020. And Alice Birch wrote the screenplay for this. You might be familiar with Alice Birch's work because she also wrote Lady Macbeth. And last year, she wrote my favourite TV show, which was Normal People. So that's number 7. Number 6, Dune. Hey. as our colleague Alex would say, the best first half of a movie of 2021. Absolutely loved that film and cannot wait for part 2.
Yeah, really amazing, especially to see, you know, in a big screen for the first time for a lot of people. Really, really stunning to see. So let's go into our top 5 now. So we'll start with you and then we'll alternate back and forth. So, Carl, what is your number 5 movie of 2021?
Okay, number 5 is Petite Maman, which is a French film directed by Céline Sciamma. I don't want to reveal too much about this because it's a very special movie, and the less you know, the better. But Celine also made Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which made my top 10 that year. And then she also co-wrote Paris 13th District, which is in my hidden gems list. And this was a film bath screening with an audience. And I fell in love with this lovely little film.
Yeah, I have yet to see this one. Celine Sciamma's Portrait of a Lady on Fire is one of my favorite movies of that year as well. Really phenomenal, and it's, you know, it's so hard for film fans, at least here in the United States, when a movie like this from a French European film director comes out, and when a movie like Portrait becomes popular over here, people are anticipating their next project, but you know they stick to the festival circuits, and so you know we're all waiting for this to get a mass release over here. So I'm very jealous this was on your list, because this is definitely on my anticipated movies. Overall, do you want to give us a synopsis of what it is, or you think that's even too much for listeners?
I of course, in these situations, you should always consult IMDb. So, right. So I've pre-vetted this, and our plot outline is just enough to tease what the film's about without giving too much away. So here we go. Nellie has just lost her grandmother and is helping her parents clean out her mother's childhood home. She explores the house and the surrounding woods. One day, she meets a girl, her same age, building a treehouse.
Mm. Yep, and that sounds just as sort of cryptic and mysterious as Portrait of a Lady on Fire is as well. So I'm very much looking forward to that. My number five is Steven Spielberg and Tony Kushner's remake of the 1961 musical classic West Side Story. I was able to see this at a screener a couple days ago. And if I'm being honest, I was pretty hesitant going into this. I was wondering, you know, I'm kind of always iffy on reboots and remakes in the first place. And I was wondering like why this was getting done. And let me tell you, shame on me for thinking that Steven Spielberg couldn't do this. You know, I found myself several times getting mad, being like, why didn't Steven Spielberg do more musicals? Because he's really, it's really phenomenal. They modernized the story to, you know, make sense in 2021. The performances were amazing. In particular, Rachel Zegler, this is her first, starring role. She was found on like a Twitter contest and she plays Maria and she was incredible. It was just such a treat and so fun to watch. I'm really anticipating you seeing it because I have a very good feeling that this is going to sneak in your list.
This is the problem, isn't it, with these lists? We're not quite at the end of the year. There are movies that are about to be released, and you can't possibly see everything before we get to talk about them. Steven Spielberg is my favorite living director. And on my actual top 10, I do call out a few of the movies that I have yet to see. And unlike you, I had every faith that Steven Spielberg could direct a musical and do it well.
Yeah, and he does an amazing job. On that same conversation, I mean, my favorite living director is Paul Thomas Anderson, and I haven't had a chance to go see Licorice Pizza yet. Which I'm sure is going to, you know, jump towards the higher end of my my best of list. But once I see it, I'll have to update it, and I'll let you know how I feel about it.
I'm in the same boat on Licorice Pizza as well. Yep.
And West Side Story is not available for streaming yet, but you should be able to go see it in theaters right now. Let's go on to your number four movie.
Hey. All right. Now, at number four, I have Last Night in Soho. Which it was directed and co-written by Edgar Wright. Edgar co-wrote this with Christy Wilson Cairns, who also wrote 1917, which did extremely well in my 2019 list. And I cannot wait to see what she writes next, because she is also scheduled to write Taika Waititi's 2025 Star Wars film. So kind of the great writing talent on this, right up there. Great cast in this one. Thomasin McKenzie, who you might know from Leave No Trace and Jojo Rabbit. Anya Taylor-Joy, of course, from 2020's TV hit Queen's Gambit. And then, sadly, it's the last film of Diana Rigg. So I'm going to use the IMDb plot outline again because I don't want to spoil too much of this. And these plot outlines are phenomenally good at giving you just the right teaser without giving too much away. So here we go. An aspiring fashion designer is mysteriously able to enter the 1960s where she encounters a dazzling wannabe singer. But the glamour is not all it appears to be. And the dreams of the past start to crack and splinter into something darker. another brilliant film by Edgar Wright. And I so loved Baby Driver. So loved The World's End. And this is a completely different film for Edgar. And it works so well.
Yeah, Thomasin McKenzie and Anya Taylor-Joy are really fantastic throughout the whole movie. They're both some of my favorite. It's hard to call Anya Taylor-Joy an up-and-coming actress at this point, but of younger Hollywood stars, I really enjoy watching and look forward to all their movies. And then for me, when I watched this, I got to see this in theater, and you know, I like you didn't travel this year, and I love London so much. Like, it is my favorite city in the world, and so getting to sit in a theater and sort of be there was a very fun experience for me. So
I got to see this at the London Film Festival. So it was very, all the jokes about London that can, because there is some humor in there
right.
as well. All the jokes about London played really, really well to the London Film Festival audiences there.
Well, if you weren't at the London Film Festival and you hadn't had a chance to check it out in theaters, Last Night in Soho is actually available to rent right now. And you can check that out on Prime Video. My number four, which was featured on the first episode of our new podcast hosted by Lizzie Bassett and Alex Logan, IMDb is obsessed, is Jane Campion's return to film The Power of the Dog, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, Kirsten Dunst, Jesse Plemons, and the incredible Cody Smit McPhee. It is about a charismatic rancher, Phil Burbank, and he inspires fear and awe in those around him when his brother brings home a new wife and her son. What a phenomenal movie. It's hard to explain. You know, it's a movie that when you watch it through, and I'll be very tight on details here because I think the beauty of this film is the third act in particular. And this movie, the third act and the finale is so rewarding that I know on multiple rewatches, and I've only had a chance to see this one time, you're going to sort of unpeel things more and more and sort of see things as they develop throughout the film because Jane Campion does such an amazing job of having the audience really wonder sort of what's going on until things sort of click and fall into place very, very cleanly. And it's a really wonderful character study of multiple people. You know, when I finished watching it, I was thinking, you know, who is the hero? Who is the villain here? Are there heroes? Are there villains? Or is it sort of just an amalgam of these people in this really lonesome Western situation? It was really, really amazing. And as I said earlier, Lizzie and Alex do an amazing job talking about this with no spoilers. I produced the episode and still went into the film completely unaware of like what was going to happen on screen. So definitely check that out. Go listen to it. But I was such a big fan of this movie. Carl, do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I saw this at the London Film Festival with an audience, with Jane Campion there, with many of the cast on stage to introduce. And you're right about kind of keeping the details kind of sketchy. And I think as Alex and Lizzie discuss, it's almost wrong to call this a Western.
Yeah.
It's something bigger than that. It just happens to be set in that kind of a context. Loved the film and loved seeing it with an audience because there was definitely a brilliant shock reaction to everything that goes on in that film. I only saw it once with an audience, unlike Alex, who saw it twice.
He loved it so much he had to go back. And I have to shout out Johnny Greenwood of my favorite band, Radiohead. who is also just an incredible score composer, film composer. He does the score for The Power of the Dog, and it's really like chilling and adds so much to the emotion and feel of the film.
The Power of the Dog is streaming now on Netflix, so you can check that out from the comfort of your own home.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
So let's go to your number three movie.
Right, so number three is Rebecca Hall's directorial debut, Passing, which I saw at Virtual Sundance. It's my favourite film of this year's Sundance Film Festival. Tessa Thompson, Ruth Nager just give amazing performances in this film. And I will, again, as usual, give you the IMDb plot outline. So Passing follows the unexpected reunion of two high school friends whose renewed acquaintance ignites a mutual obsession that threatens both of their carefully constructed realities. It is sumptuously shot in black and white by Edu Grau, who also shot the my one acting credit on IMDb. he is the DOP for Sarah Gavron's Suffragette. So it was phenomenal to see how beautiful that film looked, and went, aha! I can see some cinematographic talent here going on, but Rebecca's done a phenomenal job on this film. She also adapted Nella Larsen's novel, so she's written, she's directed this film.
But before I comment on Passing, what was your character in Suffragette again? For those who may not be familiar, where can people spot you?
Where can people spot me? Well, myself and my family can spot me because they were on set. when we shot that, I'm labeled as a committee member, and I'm in the sequence just outside of the Houses of Parliament in 1913. I'm very, very far in the background in the final cut. It actually gave me a new appreciation of how hard it is to shoot a movie. And then sadly I'm mostly on the cutting room floor in that one. But I am in the end credits, and thanks to the way the end credits are listed, which is in appearance order instead of kind of like significance order, I do actually appear before Meryl Streep. So I'm actually billed eight above Meryl Streep in the end credits. And so for back in the days when the movie came out, I could kind of like humorously claim, oh, yes, I was billed above Meryl Streep in her latest movie.
Which is something very few people can ever say.
Correct.
Yeah. On Passing, Tessa Thompson and Ruth Nega really give phenomenal performances. Ruth Negga had a bunch of praise coming out of Sundance, and they were both really phenomenal. So definitely go check that out. It was a really interesting and intriguing watch.
And of course, Tessa Thompson was in Sylvie's Love, which was very high in my top 10 last year.
And she was also in Sorry to Bother You, which was on my top 10 list from 2018. So the trend of Tessa Thompson continues. And speaking of black and white films and period pieces, my number three is Kenneth Branagh's Belfast. It stars Jude Hill, Louis McCassey, Katrina Balfe, and Jamie Dornan. It's a semi-autobiographical film about his life as a young boy and his working-class Belfast family experience in the tumultuous late 1960s, per the IMDb synopsis. And, you know, I'm a fan of Kenneth Branagh. His film Hamlet is definitely a movie that changed my life when I saw it way back in high school. It completely changed the way I looked at movies in so many ways. But so I went into this, and like I said before, having a daughter sort of changed the way I looked at movies. And this is an amazing film, but it's also so high on my list because it was the first new film that I watched where I actually had a different response to the movie because I'm now a parent. I found myself asking several times throughout the movie, like, how would I be acting with my daughter if we were in a similar situation? Mm. And it made me just view it in a completely different way and experience a movie in a way that I hadn't up until that point. So it was a very personal, deeply personal selection for me. But that being said, I highly recommend people watch it. I know there's Oscars buzz for several categories for the film. So yeah, just very, very powerful and not like sad movie, but like emotional movie to watch. Mm-hmm. Carl, did you have thoughts on Belfast?
So this is interesting. You would have loved the London Film Festival this year.
Apparently.
Because I also saw this at the London Film Festival with an audience, with Kenneth Branagh, with the cast in attendance, including Judi Dench, who received a standing ovation mm-hmm. just for being present in the room. such is her presence, I guess.
Right.
So great, absolutely brilliant film. And yeah, why it's so also yeah, it's nice we hit the black and white photography together. Yeah. There, that is kind of like an interesting coincidence in the mm-hmm. in the ranking. Now I know people think of Kenneth Branagh as kind of like the Shakespearean actor and kind of like serious director. I absolutely loved Dead Again, which is a film he directed in the early 1990s. But I'm a big Alfred Hitchcock fan, and it's kind of like a Kenneth Branagh tribute to Hitch. So check that one out as well if you're interested.
Yep, great recommendation. Moving on to our number twos. Carl, what is your number two?
All right, number two, I have Augustine Frizzell's The Last Letter from Your Lover. This captivated me because of the dual timelines again. So in a similar way to Last Night in Soho, this takes place in modern times and in the 1960s in London and on the French Riviera. Based on a Jojo Moyes novel, her novel Me Before You was adapted for the screen in 2016. We have Felicity Jones, Shailene Woodley, Joe Alwyn, and Naban Rizwan are the four kind of leads in that. And let me give you the summary. A pair of interwoven stories set in the past and present follow an ambitious journalist determined to solve the mystery of a forbidden love affair at the centre of a trove of secret love letters from 1965. So this is just my kind of film. It has a French connection in there. It has Felicity Jones, who's my favourite living actress. And it tells a really fascinating story. So completely fell in love with this one.
And where was the first time you watched this?
Oh. Now, this was not at a film festival. This was one of our Tuesday lunchtime cinema trips in a theatre. So great to see it on the big screen.
Yeah. It's a fun play between these characters. It reminded me of, for some reason, I kept thinking of the movie The Lake House with Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock.
Yes.
Because there is a sort of dual timeline. Letters are heavily sort of moving the story along. So that's what I was thinking of when I watched this. Yeah, it's a fun watch. If you like a romance period piece, this is definitely one for you. You can watch that on Netflix right now. So you can check that out. My number two is Lin-Manuel Miranda's film adaptation of Jonathan Larson's Tick, Tick, Boom. This is starring Andrew Garfield, who gives an incredible performance. Alexandra Shipp, Robin De Jesus, and Vanessa Hudgens. This is based on the musical that Jonathan Larson, who also went on to write Rent, wrote. And it's about him on the cusp of his 30th birthday. A promising young theater composer, Larson, navigates love, friendship, and the pressures of life as an artist in New York City. I first listened to Tick, Tick, Boom way back when I was a musical theater lover in high school. And I had never seen the stage play, but I fell so in love with Jonathan Larson, Rent, and Tick, Tick, Boom that when this was announced, I was so excited to see it. You know, Tick, Tick, Boom and Larson and Rent also changed me in many ways. Larson was deeply inspiring to me from a music standpoint. Just his whole life story is deeply inspiring for me as like a young creative person. And so when I watched this, it was really seeing something I never thought I would see. I saw a pretty funny tweet on Twitter where someone said, Tick, Tick, Boom is the musical theater kids endgame. Because it's sort of this thing where you never thought you'd see it. There's a lot of really fun musical theater, you know, nods and sort of cameos from people who are very important in the theater world. And it was really just so incredible for me to see. You know, I think people who aren't familiar with Larson can appreciate the film. But I think for people who really love Jonathan Larson will experience it in a very different way. And for me, Andrew Garfield was just phenomenal. You know, he learned to play piano for this role. And of course, Andrew Garfield can sing, because what can't he do? You know, he was really phenomenal. And I hope he gets to, you know, ride this momentum forward into award season as well. And, you know, you can watch it on Netflix. I can't praise this movie enough. It was just something I never thought I'd see. And he did it. Lin-Manuel Miranda and the cast and crew just did it so well and really made my heart sing when I finally got to see it. Sing, no pun intended, but it did. Carl, what were your thoughts on Tick, Tick, Boom?
Now this is interesting, because of course I'm a movie person rather than a musical theatre person. So I did not know the backstory behind Rent. So to me, this is one of the wonders of movies as a whole, being able to, you know, take you to somebody's story and then kind of like develop a renewed appreciation. Like I need to go see Rent again.
Yeah.
Right now, because of understanding how it came about and the struggles and the journey there. And I'm not going to say the major spoiler, but probably everybody on the planet apart from me knew that already. So yeah,
and watching it as like a fan of Rent, there's Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is clearly such a fan of Larson and Rent. There's so many little moments where it's like that meme of Leonardo DiCaprio pointing at the TV from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where it's like, oh, like there's a little nod there, and he really does the film and the musical justice. So let's move on to our number one movies of the year. Call.
Hey.
What is your number one?
Number one, I have Cary Fukunaga's No Time to Die. Now, this was special to me for several reasons. Number one is we were very fortunate to be able to attend the world premiere at the Royal Albert Hall in London with members of the royal family present. And this was really kind of like the big return to cinema, to theatres for us. So seeing that there was special in one way. And then I'm also a huge Alfred Hitchcock fan, as has been widely reported. and there's a brilliant sequence at the end of The Man Who Knew Too Much from 1956, which is set and shot at the Albert Hall. So I'm watching a James Bond movie in a Hitchcock location. I'd prepared myself by, I'd rewatched Spectre. So I'm kind of like, where is this story going to go? A touching way for Daniel Craig to say goodbye to the series. Rami Malek, kind of like, I could watch him in anything. Lea Seydoux, of course. But the real gem in this movie is Ana de Armas as Paloma. She is such a character. It's so well acted, and she just lights up the screen in all of her scenes. It's such a thrilling part of the movie without giving too much away. And then I went on IMDb to do a little bit of kind of trivia research for this one. And I love this little nugget here. So it's the first Bond movie for 31 years that features Q, Felix Leiter, M, and Moneypenny. So the last time we saw all of those characters in a single Bond movie was License to Kill in 1989. I'll give you the IMDb plot outline, because of course I will. So James Bond has left active service. His peace is short-lived when Felix Leiter, an old friend from the CIA, turns up asking for help, leading Bond onto the trail of a mysterious villain armed with dangerous new technology.
Similar to my feelings of wishing Steven Spielberg had done more musicals after watching West Side Story, after I watched No Time to Die, I was like, why didn't Cary Joji Fukunaga do more Bond movies? Or more just like these big action films, because it's so beautifully shot. The scenes where they're on, I'll say, the island, and they're sort of running around trying to find the villain. Some of the coolest and best-looking action sequences I've seen. And, of course, you know, one of the many Bond trademarks are the opening sequences. And Cary Joji Fukunaga just directs the opening sequence of No Time to Die so beautifully. And so well and so fun. And more call Ian best of list parody. Ana de Armas stars in Knives Out, which is one of the four films that both you and I put on our lists at the same time. So there it is, Ana de Armas connecting our rarely connected lists.
And apparently, Daniel Craig had a lot to do with her casting in No Time to Die, because he had just worked with her in Knives Out.
Yeah, I actually blanked for a second that he was in that. So there it is, yes.
So considering brilliant acting.
Scene stealing,
of course.
Exactly, right. and I agree with you. You know, I grew up with the Bond franchise. I have very fond memories of watching the movies with my grandfather. And I agree with you. Like, they really wrapped up the Craig series, mini franchise within the franchise, really well. And it was so fun to watch. And this goes to my number one, which is Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch. Starring Benicio del Toro, Adrian Brody, Tilda Swinton, Lea Seydoux again. And it is a love letter to journalists set in an outpost of an American newspaper and a fictional 20th century French city that brings to life a collection of stories published in the French Dispatch magazine. If that doesn't sound like a Wes Anderson synopsis, I'm not quite sure what does. Similar to what I said about Paul Thomas Anderson, Wes Anderson is one of the current living film directors where if I know they have a movie coming out, I am marking it on my calendar and actively counting down the days to it. And The French Dispatch, I know, was a little polarizing for some fans. But for me, I think it's actually maybe one of my top three of his films, because it felt very different to me. You know, a lot of his movies really focus on loneliness and sort of relationships with fathers. And you get touches of that throughout The French Dispatch. But The French Dispatch was the first film of his where I really felt like he was making a statement about art. And he does it, I think, exquisitely well through these little short stories within the greater film. And he says so much about the importance of collaboration and the importance of, the beauty of writing and all these sorts of things. And so it really struck me because, I went in having read a handful of reviews saying that it didn't really click with them. And it really, really stood out to me. So, I'm looking forward to watching it again because I think similar to Power of the Dog, it's a movie where I think as I rewatch it more and more, I'll sort of grab and take little more things from subsequent viewings. Cole, what were your thoughts on The French Dispatch?
So this one for me, this was another London Film Festival film, including a surprise appearance on stage at the end by Bill Murray. So he didn't make it for the intro. He'd flown in from the set of Wes's current movie, whose title he then announced on the stage of the film festival. And it does appear that he wasn't supposed to reveal that much information. So we kind of got a peek inside Wes's next movie. I do love Wes generally, but not every film hits it for me. But the thing that I admire about Wes is that he's one of those directors who is always ambitious. And to use a sports analogy, he definitely always swings for the fences. If you want to get those home runs, you've got to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, another thing that has my love for Wes Anderson and, again, Paul Thomas Anderson and Celine Sciamma is another good example is, like I said, with West Side Story, in an age of remakes and reboots and adaptations, it's so hard to find directors who really take pride in doing original stories. So that's another standout for me that, you know, on my list, there's, you know, only a handful of original stories through here. Most of them are book adaptations or play adaptations or musical adaptations. So, you know, seeing a truly original story there, I think also makes things like tick up on my list quite a bit because I just really appreciate that as that is becoming harder and harder to find, you know, as sort of the film, the trends of film have been morphing over the last, you know, however many years. But yeah, great lists, Cole, between you and me.
And you. Well, obviously you're going to think your list is great. So, yeah. But thank you for the admiration of my list and straight back at you there in terms of your choices. Well done.
do you see a theme between the films that you selected for your top 10 list by chance?
Oh my goodness. They're all great movies that I loved.
Perfect. That's really the only theme you need for a list like this, right?
And once again, if you want to check out all the other amazing best of lists that we have on IMDb, you can check that out at imdb.com/best of.
Well, Call, thank you again. As I said earlier, this is one of my favorite end of the year traditions. Now we're going on 4 strong years. I'm very much looking to our 5th year. Maybe we can increase our 10% list parody to maybe like 12%, 15% next year. So we'll see how it goes. But thank you so much for joining. It was a pleasure as always.
Yeah, onwards to our 5th edition. I'm really excited about what 2022 holds for just the range of movies that are going to be available and hopefully the opportunities for more people to see them together in theatres or at film festivals in theatres or wherever they may be in the world. It's better to be able to see the movies. So if you're only watching them at home, that's still okay.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Cole, and we'll talk soon.